you're here to hear about the perplexing parables, you're in the right place. If you want to hear something else, why, we can't. Then you need to be next door or somewhere else. But this is the final session of three on the parables. If you haven't been to the other two, that's all right. You've come to the most perplexing session of all, when we've saved what we hope are two of the most notoriously difficult parables for the church to get its hands on and understand. And these are the two, the so-called friend at midnight and the dishonest steward, both from Luke. But let us, before we get into that, tell you who we are. Who are we?
My name is Ann Palmerton, and I serve as an associate pastor at a Presbyterian church in San Diego. Brad and I met at a Presbyterian seminary, so.
But I'm a Lutheran pastor, and also in San Diego. We are married, you probably guessed. And we have a son, Martin, who's 10 months old, who's terrorizing Chalet 7 at the moment, probably. Who knows?
And not sleeping for the night.
Right.
Right. We're still waiting. So we're glad to be here. Welcome. You may want to steal a chair from next door, and feel free to do that and drag it on it now, whatever.
Okay, should we?
We'll launch right in, because we got a lot to try to share here and to talk about. Rather than start with a prayer, which we've been doing, I thought I'd start, well, this is kind of a prayer, but it's a short poem from Robert Frost. This is also a little invitation for any of you who are still in the vision in the village on Wednesday. I'll be doing a session on doing theology with Robert Frost, when we'll be looking at some Frost poems and then trying to sort out the theological meaning. Here's a very short poem. It's called Not All There. It seems somehow to relate to this parable of the friend at midnight. You maybe have had the experience that he talks about in this poem. I turned to speak to God about the world's despair. To make bad matters worse, I found God wasn't there. God turned to speak to me. Don't anybody laugh. God found I wasn't there. At least not over half.
And with that, we begin. Let's turn to Luke chapter 11, and we're going to look at the parable and the friend at midnight, and then we're going to look at the context within which it's set, so you'll get a feeling for what precedes and follows it. Should I read it?
Go ahead.
Okay, I'll read the parable for us, beginning with verse 5 there, chapter 11. And Jesus said to them, "Which of you who has a friend will go to him at midnight and say to him, 'Friend, lend me 3 loaves, for a friend of mine has arrived on a journey and I have nothing to set before him.' And he will answer from within, 'Do not bother me, the door is shut. The door is now shut and my children are with me in bed. I cannot get up and give you anything.' I tell you, though he will not get up and give him anything because he is his friend, yet because of his importunity, he will rise and give him whatever he needs." Okay? Tricky parable. Preceded by Jesus talking with his disciples and Luke's version of the Lord's Prayer there in the first 4 verses of chapter 11, and followed by another very familiar verse in the Bible, beginning with verse 9, "And I tell you, ask and it will be given, seek and you will find, knock and it will be open." And then the little, I don't know if you call it a parable or a mini story about, you know, what father among you, if his son asks for a fish, will give him a serpent, if he asks for an egg, will give him a scorpion, that kind of word. So this whole section here is on the topic of prayer. And the parable seems to give us advice, on the surface at least, give us advice about prayer that that doesn't seem to quite mesh with how we understand prayer. Advice that says the effectiveness of prayer depends on our persistence.
Come in. You may want to borrow a chair from next door, or
Okay. Find
a table or floor space or whatever.
We'll get a chair.
Okay.
Yeah. Should we move up here a little? Yeah. It's
yeah. Can place. If can you just
pull up?
Okay. Looking more cozy.
I know. This
will also
time
sound
to do
great
a session
on the tape recording.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, every parish pastor wishes that he or she had this power on Sunday morning to say to people, come on up front.
only one row.
All over here.
It's like to sit in the back. Let's do take a look, and I know not all of you have Bibles, we ran out, but let me just touch on what's the content of this little parable. What's actually going on here, and this will refresh it in our minds. Because again, it seems to give rather odd and perplexing advice on the surface, that the effectiveness of prayer depends on importunity, or translated as persistence in the New Revised Standard, probably a little better translation. We've got here two men who are friends. They live apparently in a small village. This would not be uncommon in the ancient Middle East. Everybody would probably know everybody, maybe something like Holden Village. Company comes late in the evening to the one friend. Again, that seems a little odd to us, you know, couldn't they have planned a little better? But actually in a hot desert climate like that often was, it wasn't uncommon that people traveled at night, traveled by moonlight. It was easier to travel. So showing up at midnight was not really all that odd. Now, we also know, of course, that in this Middle Eastern culture, it was a cultural expectation that a person must entertain guests when they come. That was just not an option, because one never knew when you might find yourself in the same situation in need of someone's hospitality. Therefore, you would, of course, extend yourself and do whatever you could. Notice that he asks in verse 5, "Friend, lend me 3 loaves. Apparently, that was the standard portion of bread for a meal. According to, I think, Jeremias and others who studied this parable, they point that out. But what did I do with that book? Parables of Jesus, Joachim Jeremias, in the Holden Library. If you really want to dig into parables, highly recommend that. Even though, you know, obviously one person couldn't eat 3 loaves of bread, it was still part of this cultural courtesy that you would offer to a person, even if it were just one person, the full meal. So that's why he's going asking for help. Now, it's also the case that, you know, bread doesn't stay fresh on the shelf very long if you don't put preservatives in it. I mean, that's how Wonder Bread stay so wondrously wonderful. But that's why at Holden we basically eat the day's supply of bread every day, because without preservatives it gets hard and stale. So a person wouldn't stock up a lot of extra loaves in the pantry. So it's not necessarily poor planning on this person's part that he doesn't happen to have extra bread. Person shows up unexpectedly, that's just the way it goes. You wouldn't hesitate in this situation to ask your friends for help. It's just what you would be very natural. People would do this. Yeah, go ahead.
How do you know he's got 3 loaves?
Well, we don't know that.
Then why don't you ask him? Why don't you say, "Friend, do you have any loaves of bread for me to have?"
Ah, well, that may have something to do with the overall meaning of the parable. Yeah. Oh, and it may be pressing the point farther than what Jesus intends to be made. I don't know. That's a very rational question, isn't it? Except here, it's just simply, the assumption is this person can provide. Let's hang on to that issue, because when we get a little deeper in, I think that'll surface as a key element here. I just want to try to get the gist of what the situation is. We also have this person, notice he says,
Seven.
Yeah, "Don't bother me, the door," it sounds like W.C. Fields, doesn't it? "Go away, don't bother me. The door is shut, my children are with me in bed." Well, have to be a big bed. Probably they slept on the floor. And that would mean if you were kind of lined up in a small dwelling, you know, you'd have to step over people to get in, the door was shut and bolted for the night. That would have been a cumbersome, noisy process. Believe me, with a 10-month-old infant, you don't want to get up and crawl over people, but, you know, all this sort of thing. So culturally, I hope that paints a little picture of maybe what some of the dynamics are here that are going on. Now, that takes us to let's go back. Verse 5. This is a case where I think the Revised Standard translation is much better than the New Revised Standard. I must say, the more I work with this New Revised Standard, I keep hitting these little things where I feel like they have done a bit of paraphrasing that takes, they're not really being truthful to the Greek always, and I find it kind of unnerving. If you look this up in the New Revised Standard, verse 5 reads, and he said to them, suppose you have a friend, which is very different from how this is worded when it begins with the question word, which of you has a friend? Notice that the question runs all the way down through verse 7. It's a long question. And I think that's very important because there are other parables in Luke's gospel that also start out with this exact same phrasing of which of you, da 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 da. And every time that happens, it's clear that Jesus expects a negative answer. For instance, in Luke 12, Jesus asks, which of you by being anxious can add a cubit to his or her lifespan? And of course, the obvious answer is no one can do that. It's impossible. Luke 14, which of you having an ox or a son that falls into a well wouldn't pull him out on the Sabbath day? And the obvious answer is no one would do that. Everyone, of course, would do that. Sabbath or no Sabbath, you would do it. Jesus asks, which of you desiring to build a tower does not first count the cost? And of course, the obvious negative answer would be, well, no one would do that. I mean, you would of course count the cost. What man of you, Jesus asks, having 100 sheep wouldn't leave the 99 and search for the one? The answer is no one. I mean, you would of course do that. Will any of you who has a servant plowing or keeping sheep say to him when he comes in from the field, have a seat at my table? Of course not. I mean, anyway, there are these negative examples that this very wording sets up, which should be a clue to us then to say that if Jesus is starting into this saying, which of you who has a friend, at some point there needs to be a question mark, and at some point it needs to be expected that people would be shaking their heads and say, well, nobody would do that. Okay? In other words, let me try to read this again and get the question framework. Which of you has a friend who will go to him at midnight and say to him, friend, lend me 3 loaves, for a friend of mine has arrived on a journey, and I have nothing to set before him, and he will answer from within, do not bother me, the door is now shut, and my children are with me in bed, I cannot get up and give you anything. Question.
No.
No, they wouldn't act like that.
Nobody would act like that.
But no. Okay. What are you talking about? When you say, which of you, are you talking about the person who asked or the person who answered?
That's where we're going.
That's deep into the whole story.
Exactly.
But,
that's good.
Yeah, the question, really, maybe if we crunch it, it would be like this. Which of you has a friend who, in response to your request, would say, bug off? And the answer would be, nobody in our village has friends like that. That would be unthinkable behavior. Nobody would say that. We don't know anybody who, if we went to them with that sort of earnest request, would say, forget it, I can't do it. And so, verse 7, I think, is not really a refusal of the request, but rather Jesus using a touch of humor to show how preposterous this kind of response would actually be. No one in the village, in this culture, in these circumstances, would put across that kind of response. I mean, who it's unthinkable. Who of you could imagine this? No, but we can't imagine that. That's incredible. That's absolutely preposterous. This is where when I was working on this a few weeks ago because it was the lectionary lesson, and I was very intrigued by this which of you issue. And then I noticed that in the bulletin inserts we use in our church, which has the New Revised Standard, it had totally taken the question away and had introduced with this much more casual, suppose you have a friend. And I whipped my Greek New Testament down, which is on a pretty high shelf, by the way.
Yeah.
Very much. It's pretty nasty. And I looked and I compared and I said, I ran out to the kitchen. Anne's reading the paper. Her Greek is a lot better than mine. And I said, look at this. Can you believe this? They have changed this in the New Revised Standard. I mean, this is incredible. How can they get away with this? And you remember what you said?
Yeah. I said, who are you going to call? Bible busters?
that may just mean that it's very important to use more than one translation.
You don't bring another question in later on?
They don't.
Suppose this happens.
you wouldn't say
Now, in fairness to the people who've worked out that translation, I mean, in the ancient Greek, there is no punctuation. So that's we have to supply that in our English understanding. But I think because it begins very clearly with the same words in Greek that these other phrases do I mentioned a second ago, which of you has, I think it's very clearly intending to set up a question that would imply a negative response. So then we're really at the crux of the parable then by the time we get to verse 8. And here I will give the translators of the New Revised Standard a lot of credit. I think they've done better. They have not insisted on using this word importunity. I mean, who talks like that anymore, right? The word simply means persistence. And in fact, I think sometimes in the New Testament it's even translated that way. Because of his persistence, he will rise and give him what's needed. So Jesus is saying there's more than just the matter of friendship at stake here. There is the matter of persistence. Uh-huh, yes. But now, the question is, whose persistence are we talking about? The persistent asker or the persistent giver, I think. You can explain it from here because I'll get lost.
Okay, if we look at verse 8, I tell you, though he, the person in the room, right, will not get up and give him, the person knocking, anything because he is his friend, right, the person in the room is the friend of the person, yet because of his importunity, whose importunity? Well, that's the understanding of the people who did the New Revised Standard, and that's why they didn't use the question format with the verse 5.
But that isn't right.
Well, it's not clear.
Oh, take a careful look, you know, because of his importunity. Inside or outside?
He won't get up and give it to him simply because he's a friend, but because he's so persistent, he will get up and give it.
Right, that's the classic understanding.
Is it right? I don't know.
Well, we're going to suggest another
angle. It's another way to look. Yeah. That's why it's a perplexing parable.
And what? So we're going to ask you to look at that, you know, the second part of verse 8 and say, yet because of his importunity, and we're going to suggest the person in the room, because of his importunity, he will rise and give him whatever he needs.
His
persistence.
How is he persistent?
Well, notice this. I mean, if you read a lot of commentaries on this, the explanation you get is, and so his friend was there banging on the door, repeatedly knocking and knocking and having to wake him from sleep. I defy you to find that in the parable. There's nothing to suggest here that the man doing the knocking had to do anything more than knock once. I mean, there is nothing in here to suggest that he was out there beating the door down. Although you can seize on that issue of persistence and say, well, perhaps he was doing that, but it's not necessarily clear that that's really the behavior that's being exhibited.
But he didn't go away.
Unclear pronoun reference at its worst.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Why did Jesus have to be so obscure? But
an English teacher.
Well,
but does your Greek help you with that word importunity? It doesn't.
Well, it that simply means persistence. It's pretty clear. I mean, that there's not a. It means persisting to carry on.
Persisting as being in the same state you are in. So if he's in bed with his children, he's going to persist in staying in bed with his children.
Well, but it says because of his persistence or importunity, he will get up. He will rise. He will rise and give because of his persistent attitude, if you read it as an attribute of the person inside sleeping. But think about this for a second theologically. What the theological implications are, depending on who we attribute the persistent... I think that's where we wanted to go with this, right? Okay. go ahead.
I'm talking in the context of the Lord's Prayer. Your kingdom come, give us this, forgive us, do not bring us to the... You're asking God for something.
Yes, but are you asking 50 million times? Are you out there banging on God's door saying, please, 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 and if I pray enough, I'll get it?
Well, wouldn't once a day be enough? Give us this day our daily bread?
Yeah.
That's seems not persistence. I don't have to say it. I mean, I've been fed fairly well, and I don't know if I pray. The Lord's Prayer that often.
Mike, did you have a comment? Jump in.
Well, again, it's immediately followed by ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find. And
yeah.
That seems to be consistent with the classical understanding of this. And
but it doesn't say ask twice.
But does our asking influence God's generosity? I think that that's what we're trying to get at. Does our persistence, our repeated knocking, influence the generosity, the amount or the depth of the generosity of God?
It makes us ready to receive.
Perhaps.
Does it change the outpouring of the gifting of the Holy One? I guess that's the way we want to get at the perplexing one, is to push the classical understanding and to work on the shift and say it's not ask, seek, knock. It's this ask and seek and knock.
Kind of an earnest, honest, heartfelt prayer is sufficient.
So God is the persistent one.
Well, that's where we're at.
Yeah, think about this theologically then. What does it mean then if instead of talking about us as persistent askers, which I think has some theological problems, because it means God is kind of reserved and say, well, you know, if you play the tune just right, I may dance to it. Rather, if God is characterized as the persistent giver, then we're left to ask, in what ways does God persist with us, even though we have not been a good friend, necessarily? The Bible describes God in many places, I think, as the one who is long-suffering, whose steadfast love endures forever, this idea of the hesed love of God in the Old Testament. Maybe we could talk about this as the parable of the persistent giver. Maybe the issue is, you know, what kind of a friend is God? Is God a sort of fair weather friend who only comes around and responds if you plead and plead and plead, or is God the kind of friend who's always ready to help? I wonder if it maybe isn't the case that so few of us have friends or are the kinds of friends that will, with one simple request from someone, say, I'm glad to do it. You know, we live in a culture where it's a lot more, I don't really want to extend myself unless it's very clear that I don't really have a choice. And of course, if it's a compelling reason and they can build the case, you know, I'll do that and they would do it for me. This is a different kind of culture, again, where Jesus is setting up this question expecting the negative answer, that of course no one would deny this. It would be unthinkable. It would be rude. It would be it wouldn't happen. Someone said that, one of the things, of course, that Christianity is all about is giving a whole new insight into the meaning of religion and the characterization of who God is. Someone said that the glory of being a god in pagan thought, ancient religions, so forth, was not having to worry about the human slime in the first place. Right? In other words, you could put people off. You know, gods were far above and removed, and it was a sort of, don't bother me, you know. All right, I can deign to. The incarnation means that God comes into our experience persistently giving to us, if only we make ourselves available. But anyway, back here, then up here.
This fits a bit, because if you look where or has gone previously in chapter 10, he's just finished with the story of the Good Samaritan. You know, who is neighbor? Who is friend? And that is followed by the story of Mary and Martha. Talking about Martha being distracted, but Mary choosing the right path, the best portion, mm-hmm. and being friend, being there, being present.
Yeah, available.
Yeah.
Let's jump up here. Somebody else said a comment here, and then back to Mike. Go ahead.
There is another parable later on too, though, where some lady goes to a judge and bugs him.
That's
and
true.
So is it these hands? This is a kind of parable about her.
And I would want to say, and also when this parable of the friend at midnight comes up in the lectionary, it's linked with the Old Testament story of Abraham badgering God about, bargaining down how many righteous people can be found, and see, that's an interesting choice on the part of the people who frame the lectionary. I think I would say that, there may be biblical reference points that do suggest that our persistence in approaching God has merit. But I think that here may be a parable that balances that and asks us to also realize that God is a persistent giver. I wouldn't want to characterize all of theology. I don't think we're trying to do that on this one parable, but trying to look at this for its own merit and say this may also provide some balance to, because this business about the woman beseeching the unrighteous judge is a naughty one, for sure. Let's see, Mike had his hand up and then over here.
I was going to respond to that parable also.
Oh, okay, your thunder was stolen.
That sentence in verse 8 is set up. It says, I tell you, though he will not get up and give him anything because he is his friend. It says the friendship is not the reason. It has to be something else. Because of his persistence, he will rise. So there's something else that's causing his persistence. And that would be either the social structure or the expectation of the community or love, something that's not friendship. It seems to be pointing, saying it's not friendship, it's something else. So does that tell us something about God's giving to us?
I think it could.
It isn't friendship.
If we are not always on a friendly basis with God, if the relationship is broken and yet God still continues
like
to give.
Like covenant or...
Yeah, it's a covenant. Yeah. Yeah. It's spoken like a true Calvinist.
Did you have a point?
Isn't that who is this friend who has the 3 loaves of bread at midnight?
Right. We're back to your point from earlier.
In a situation where they're consuming all the bread, who in the village would have 3 extra loaves of bread left at midnight?
And that's where I was thinking this was a good question you raised earlier, but wanted to save it till now. That adds for me, or reinforces for me, that it's the person who's being asked who is really cast in the God role, the providing role, where you wouldn't ask the question of, gee, do you have enough? You could just come with the expectation, this person can provide. Give me today my daily bread. Literally, by bread for tomorrow, give me today, is the literal meaning of the Lord's Prayer phrase, and that would also apply here. Yeah, I think that builds the case that we're trying to build, I guess.
Is this word persistence ever translated to steadfastness?
I might have the word steady on that. I don't know. But I do.
I'm not sure we have the word steady with us.
Oh, okay. I'll keep looking. I don't know if I have that here or not. So somebody else asked that question.
Should I move on? Go ahead.
I'll see if I can find it.
We'd like to undergird this by saying, if the focus of the parable is on the persistence of the asker, then the notion is that it's our task to pray for a change. That is, it's our task to pray hard and to pray often and to pray the change into being. But in verse 10, there's... later on, after our parable, there's no real emphasis on repeated asking, seeking, and knocking. Everyone
who asks receives, and the one who seeks finds, and the one who knocks it shall be opened. It kind of seemed to us a bit like that Nike commercial that we're so familiar with. Just do it, you know. Just do it, and doing it over and over and over again isn't the focus. It's the doing it, and that we don't have to pray the same prayer until we're blue in the face. That God is more dependable than that. That our heartfelt, earnest prayer is sufficient. And so it gets maybe to the heart of my own life, which is it's not the quantity of prayers, it's the quality of them, which we might say instead of praying for a change, how about if we pray for a change? You know, maybe that's the new emphasis out of this parable for us.
And to just push on to the very end of that paragraph in verse 13, where Jesus talks about how much more will the Heavenly Father give the Holy Spirit to those who ask? I mean, that's not a bad question for us. Have we, in fact, prayed for the Spirit, which is what Jesus, you know, at the end of this little discourse, promises? You know, I mean, that's just one way to ask the question. Have we prayed for that presence in our lives? I don't know, somebody else had a hand up here. Where are you? There you are.
Anna's grandma.
Regarding what you said you don't have to pray without ceasing, as Paul said, but if you pray for a friend or something, is it enough to pray just once, or should you pray for that friend constantly? I mean, you can't just say, I've got a sick friend, I want to pray for him or her, and leave it at that and say, well, God heard your prayer, and leave it alone, or do you pray constantly?
I think that, as Brad mentioned before, we were hoping to kind of stir things up and maybe see this as a corrective in the scheme of things, that we, you know, acknowledging Paul's pray without ceasing, the goal of the Christian life, you know, is that constant communion and that understanding and connectedness.
I think it depends on how we define prayer. And I think Luther tried to help us understand that prayer really is something that we need to do. God knows what we need before we ask. Mm-hmm. So we aren't in any way influencing God. But we need to express our confidence in Him that He can provide. It's a faith. It's being in the presence of God, ready to receive from God, because, you know, He knows before we ask what we're going to ask for.
And I would say, picking up on what Ann said about the kind of just a balancing to the notion of the continual praying without ceasing, that opening yourself to God in this way, I think we can get out of this parable a meaning of prayer that says, I don't want to enter into prayer assuming that, well, I'm going to have to be at this a long time. You know, I'll do it today, but I'll be back tomorrow. You know, can we enter in with the first prayer, a kind of earnest, honest, heartfelt, focused prayer? And yes, it may not be answered, and we may be back tomorrow praying the same issue. But in order to keep us from kind of trivializing prayer, just sort of adding that one person onto our list of prayer concerns, and we just become repetitious and it can quickly become trivial. To take Jesus seriously, that if you knock, if you seek, if you ask, things get opened. And see what happens.
Brad, I was raising my
hand. Oh, sorry. Thank you.
No problem.
Point of shame.
No, I'm teasing. In line with what you said before about Luther in prayer, about God knows what we need, we are praying also for change within ourselves. And I read the neatest thing one time, that when you pray for a gift, we become that gift. If you pray for love, you become loving. If you pray for forgiveness, you become forgiving. And so this is part of that too, you know, this persistence is not only because we want something and we need something, but also so that it affects us and changes us.
If you pray for bread, do you become yeast or what?
Yes, exactly. Salt. How about
leaven?
Yeah.
Salt, not baking. Plenty of
it.
But if we look,
switch,
if we look towards Jesus hard. For an example, though, he was persistent in prayer, like let this cup be taken from me.
over and over, three or four times, I think.
And yet, in a very focused time frame. I mean, we don't have a sense that that was a persistent theme of his ongoing ministry. It came to crunch time, and then it became a very earnest moment. And I think there's more than one way to see that.
So we know you all heard sermons on this. Chances are good. A few weeks ago.
Perhaps, yeah. Some of you preached on it, struggled with it.
Yeah.
At the risk of just rushing, we have another. If you thought this one was perplexing,
yeah.
We've got one more to look. Are you ready to make a switch and go to Luke 16?
Okay.
We need to provide to that.
You
want to
do it?
Let's just jump in.
Okay. You want to read it, honey?
Okay. You'll notice I put up here Luke 16, 1-9, ? There's a lot of controversy among people who have studied this parable about exactly where it ends. We're willing to let it go through verse 9.
But then it's over.
No farther than that. Absolutely not. But maybe even less than that. Let me read it here. He also said to his disciples, that is Jesus, there was a rich man who had a steward, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Turn in the account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be a steward. And the steward said to himself, what shall I do, since my master is taking the stewardship away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that people may receive me into their houses when I am put out of the stewardship. So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said, take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonored steward for his shrewdness. Now, some people suggest that's the end of the parable right there, and that everything else is commentary on the parable, so you might keep that in mind. But let's press on. For the children of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the children of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous mammon, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal habitations. I think really, wherever we choose to end the parable proper, and the parable scholars always make a big point about that. Nonetheless, it's all still scripture for us. We got to deal with the second half of 8 and 9 one way or the other. So we might as well try to work, interpretation from that as well.
So obviously, this is a perplexing parable, and the challenge is, and I think for preachers and studiers, where's the good news in this? What do we find in this that can be a word to us today? So we have some suggestions, and then we'll share some of those, and then we can plunge in with some discussion.
Yeah, it might just take on the title of this parable for a second. We've traditionally come to know it as the parable of the unjust steward, although that word unjust I don't believe is actually used here. The King James description. Well, in the same one here, in verse 8, is the dishonest steward. So we think about it in that way. But that word actually means unrighteous, I think, is the literal meaning. But one of the key descriptive phrases that we have for the steward is actually in verse 1, about wasting, that he was a wasteful steward. And yet, with all the focus in the parable about the steward, the master is actually every bit as much a major character. In verse 2, he's very much in the fore, condemning the steward, and yet somehow, notice, even though he condemns him, he lets him continue to do business. He doesn't get him out of the household altogether. He leaves him in a position where he still has contact with the creditors, which is rather strange, seems to me.
So we've kind of got a story here of the wasteful steward and in some ways the surprising master who rebukes but doesn't, at least not yet, does not dismiss. It's like, you're going to be put out, but I'll give you a little while to get things in order and...
A little while to cheat me.
Well, yeah, why would he do that?
That's,
yeah,
maybe too much notice,
maybe. The original union arrangement. Well,
let's go over quickly then the kind of three acts that occur in the flow of the story so that we can focus in on what's happening. The kind of as the curtain opens and act one begins, that we see that the steward is wasteful, as Brad said, and possibly lazy, you know, and that he fails to do what he was charged to do, so he loses his job. And then we see that the steward decides to shrewdly, as they put it, take care of himself by cheating his master further, by going out to those people who owe the master money and making those debts smaller so that he'll ingratiate himself with all of those people who owe money.
Well, and I would want to say at this point, pox on those commentators again, these parable interpreters, who get something out of this that's not really here. You often read comments about this and they say, well, the master was grateful, you know, because at least he got something out of these creditors where he might not have gotten anything at all. The parable doesn't say that. I mean, the guy was being cheated. That's the whole point. In fact, he got paid less than what he was owed. There's no reason to think that was a great move. I mean, he was entitled to get paid what was owed to him, and he should have gotten paid. And it's surprising that somehow he lets it happen the way that it does. So I pox on the commentator. Anyway.
So that was act two.
Okay.
So the third act...
Can we call Bible busters?
Right. The third act there is simply in verse 8, that and that's a surprising subversion of our expectations, a surprising outcome where the master then, who has been cheated twice, commends the steward for his shrewdness.
Not.
Pardon?
There's a missing word there, not.
That's good.
Again, then, if we, you know, this is a teaching of Jesus, and it seems to me we deservedly ought to ask of parables, where's the good news? I mean, is there good news in this parable? Or is this just some sort of, you know, I don't know what you'd say. I mean, is there any good news here? Most of the explanations of this parable get us fastened in on the character of the steward to the exclusion of the character of the master, even though he's every bit as much a major player in the story. And so we end up with interpretations of this that say, well, the steward became prudent. That was good. You know, he faced the challenge like he'd never faced it before. He saw the light. When crunch time came, at least he got some gumption and some energy and did some things.
He's a survivor.
Yeah, he's a survivor, and therefore you too, you know, in the face of adversity, can be a survivor. Yeah, go ahead.
I wonder about this, that if these people did mark their IOUs down, as it was suggested by the steward, then if he has ingratiated them and he becomes good friends with them, then he deserves the friends he's got.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, because they would be dishonest as well. Yeah. Did you have a comment in the back there?
I was going to say, what was he to gain by doing this?
Possibly another job down the road.
The will of the people who had owed the formerly the larger amount. So now he had all these friends and said, "Hey, we saved some money here. We saved some wheat. We saved some oil."
But
so
they don't say that.
But again,
yes, it does.
Yeah.
It says that. It says that he. Let's see.
He's dinner.
So when I am dismissed as manager, people may welcome me into their home.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, let's jump up here, please.
Yeah, the only way I've been able to make sense out of this parable for me is that is the graciousness of the master. That's how I see it. That time and time again, this master is tolerating all kinds of stuff, and yet he still keeps him on. And in a sense, for me, that's the graciousness of God. So I hear good news in this.
Yeah.
I've never been able to make sense out of looking at the steward.
From the steward, yeah.
But the eternal home, the last line in verse 9, the eternal homes are the homes of the people that mark down their bills. And you haven't mentioned them at all. They're the third party in this whole thing. They're the people that are going to welcome him and take care of him forever. That's something only God can do. So the people who mark down the bills, could they be God?
Well, which eternal home is that?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's right. Things are hot and cold. I would want to say maybe we can let a bit of the two preceding verse 8 and verse 9 do some interpretive work for us. See, I like very much, and I certainly resonate with what you're saying, that we tend to overlook the character of the master. We get all focused in on the shrewdness and the cleverness. You know, we always want to identify ourselves with some character. We think, that's pretty neat. This guy was clever. I like that. Rather than seeing the modeling that's being done in terms of the graciousness of the master. If really, when you think about it, I mean, the steward starts out wasteful. He's accused of being wasteful, and he ends up wasteful. I mean, he squanders. I mean, he marks down everything. He's still wasting. He doesn't experience any character change. He's as predictable as ever. I mean, he's a lout when we start. He's a lout at the end. The truly surprising character, I think, is the master. It's an invitation, perhaps, back to what we said a couple sessions ago about how parables reverse our expectations. This may be an invitation to reverse our expectations about the way that God operates, if we can identify God with the master, or the way that we ought to operate if we're in that position. We expect people who cheat God to get chopped off at the knees. But in this story, the person in that role leaves the steward free to keep on doing, you know, what's been done, and it so that it can sort itself out. Now, to get to the last couple of verses, though, and this is the only way I've been able to make sense out of this, frankly, after a lot of hammering it back and forth, is that there's a touch of irony in this. And that's why I think I want to include the end of verse 8 in the parable. The children of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the children of light. If you hear that as an ironic comment on Jesus' part, a sadly ironic comment, that may begin to focus this. It was about a year or so ago in California, there was this huge lottery jackpot, a $55 million lottery jackpot. And, of course, everybody's buying lottery tickets then. Turns out the people who won this thing were 20 people from the phone company who pooled their money. And they interviewed them afterwards, and the woman who was in charge of, you know, every week she'd go around and pick up $5 from all these fellow office workers, and she said, exact quote, she said, "We played the lottery religiously." Now, the children of this world looking after their own concerns, being so shrewdly diligent about feathering their nest. You know, I got to thinking as I was doing a little computing, if every person in my congregation would contribute $5 more a week, it would mean that our budget our giving would go up by something like $25,000 for the year. I mean, $5 a week, folks, it's not that much. We're not even a huge congregation. We thought, if the children of light, well, should say it this way, it's unfair to pit the children of darkness and the children of light, or this world and the kingdom against each other. We are both. We are justified and sinful at the same time. We are both. It's just in when we're dealing with one realm, we tend to be so shrewd and deliberate, and when dealing with the other realm, so casual and wasteful and squandering. Maybe it's just a touch of irony on Jesus' part to say, what's to keep you from being so, you know, so persevering or so shrewd and diligent in all of your behavior?
Could he be saying that, if we want to put it in our terminology, that the non-Christians are more Christian than the Christians?
Oh, that's too uncomfortable. That would be classic parable language where you'd come away from hearing what Jesus said
and say,
I'm not sure I like that.
I don't like that. I think he's talking about me, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's why people got often very upset when they heard Jesus' parables. They had the sense that these were pointed at them.
Any other comments?
Well, the other thing is that it's the last verse 9 seems to say that this is all stuff, and it doesn't really concern us really at all. It's unrighteous man, and you make friends with that, and then when it fails, it doesn't matter to you, because it's simply riches, simply earthly wealth.
Yeah, if that's an ironic comment, then I think that fits quite well.
What do they mean when it fails?
Well, then 13, we're not continuing to 13, but if you were.
If we were. No, that's important.
You know, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You can't serve God and mammon. That's kind of sticking the point further what you were saying.
There's also, back to verse 9, notice the language, so that when it fails, they may receive you. If you go back up to verse 4, very same language, so that people may receive me. That's often a clue. When you get parallel language like that in a story, you know that there's a connection. That's an argument for extending the parable through verse 9 and seeing the bigger picture.
In other words,
it's going to
give everybody a real good deal. And then because that's what the steward did to the first debtors. So if you do that too, you'll make friends with them later.
I think so.
Is that what he's talking about?
Well, you're saying structurally that the parallel use of those phrases
may receive.
Comes together.
I guess I would argue for that in the sense of then seeing verse 9 as an ironic comment that frames the end of it and does help interpret what has preceded. That may be doing more than we actually need to do with it.
Well, it's sort of making use of money rather than letting money use you.
Yeah. I could own that. Yeah. Love people, use things, don't use people to love things. Is everybody else as warm in here as I am?
Yeah. Yeah. Very hot.
Well,
you're right. Are you as perplexed as you were when we
came
in?
Yeah.
Doesn't verse 10 tell us something?
I don't know. We stopped before we got there.
I think that's why various commentators have wanted to cut that verse off, because the steward's actions have been so problematic through the history of the church. You know, this has been one of those things that people have wished they could just cut out.
And even so that the original, the very first editors and Luke and whatever putting it together is already trying perhaps to explain the perplexing, seemingly inconceivable. But Dave, you...
I'll just put in one more plug. I realize this doesn't help you, the Lutheran pastors who need to make a grace-filled sermon out of all this. But I think that there's a fairly reasonable interpretation of that parable that simply says, you know, if you're talking about bargaining with the children,
the children of the world
versus the children of the world, I think it's saying, hey, you chose your friend. I mean, you've got this choice. I've rebuked you, but I've left you in a position where you can, you're still in the household. You choose rather to ally yourself with these debtors, the other folks. And so when it all falls apart, you get to go with the other folks, and you know, and you're not a part of the master's household anymore. I mean, I really was serious about that. Which eternal inhabitation are you talking about? Because if you choose to not think about it in terms of a totally grace-filled thing instead of somewhat of a imprecatory or condemnation kind of thing, I think it really can say, choose your friends, you know, and if you want to be shrewd in the worldly ways, go with the world, and if you want to be shrewd in the godly ways, you can... Just as an alternative.
Could this have something to do with forgiveness? Is that another angle? Because this man forgave half the debt, and the master's forgiving him for cheating him. I mean, it's kind of like that the parable of the king who forgave his servant and the servant didn't forgive. I mean, this is the master's forgiving him certainly for being.
But the impetus for the steward forgiving is to feather his own nest rather than a.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a it's.
Well.
Yeah. In the back.
I'm getting that this whole thing is a sort of a metaphor for grace, because there's absolutely nothing that this cur has done to deserve. I mean, he's still the same old cur that he was. You know, he's just worldly wise, and it's sort of like his master has absolutely no reason to act this way towards him with his benevolence and generosity, but he does anyway. And the startling thing about it is that he really doesn't have it coming. He doesn't deserve it. I mean, the thing that stands out for me in this is that there's absolutely nothing that he's done that to deserve his good fortune.
Yeah. It doesn't say that the master commended.
Yes.
And that's where the rub comes in, I think.
Oh,
Christ God doesn't commend us for doing wrong.
That seems where your irony word comes in to me. I think it's pretty nasty, that commendation.
Commend or condemn what?
What do you mean nasty?
Oh, well, you've done pretty well for yourself, haven't you? That's all I get out of it.
I don't know, Esther, if this goes back to your question about verse 9, but if you read verse 9, as if Jesus is saying that with a kind of twinkle in his eye and a bit of the touch of irony. And when we read these words of Jesus, we often take everything as if it's Sermon on the Mount material delivered with, you know, the Franco Zeffirelli type Jesus that just stares you down. But, I mean, couldn't Jesus be rendering the words in verse 9 with a kind of twinkle in his eye? You know, so I tell you, you know, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous mammon so that when it fails, they'll receive you into eternal habitations. As if to say, come on, folks, you know that that's not really how it's supposed to work, you know? I mean, can we attribute to Jesus some sense of the ironic or the humorous or, you know, poking people a little bit to get them to think? Perhaps, why not?
Why did we stop at 9?
Because we only had half an hour. No. It was a somewhat arbitrary choice on our part, because you'll find different scholars who would slice this all the way back, some to verse 7, and say that it ends there. And then 8, first half of 8, second half of 8, add in 9, go to 10, go to the end of the chapter.
Just makes it more difficult.
I'll give you this Robert Frost poem to think about as you go home. It's called Provide, Provide, and I always think of this story and that poem together. It helps in this poem if you know who Abishag was. Anybody know out of the Old Testament the character of Abishag?
David's electric blanket.
Yeah, David's electric blanket, exactly. When David is old and feeble and cold, they search the kingdom for the most beautiful woman, and it's this woman, Abishag. And medicinal purposes only, of course. She's brought in to comfort and sleep with and keep him warm. Well, knowing that helps you understand the first part of this. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag, the picture pride of Hollywood. Too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate. Or, if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on being simply true. What worked for